Angela Davis, one of the Black Panthers. She said, "I'm no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I'm changing the things I cannot accept."
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Call Her Madam podcast.
Hello. I just want to say on behalf of Belle and I, we are very excited to welcome you into our episode 2 of our COVID-19 and the Gen Z digital advocacy season. With us, we have Kylie Foster and Tatiana Washington, two amazing women who kind of, I can say this, I think, on behalf of Belle and I, that are really inspirational and just inspire us to kind of be better within our community and advocate for all individuals within our community. I personally know Kylie because her and I both work in the DC Rethinking DC GW cohort. Kylie's actually one of the co-founders of the cohort, and we look to more research based on how to improve relationship between DC youth and the MPD. So Kylie, if you would want to introduce yourself.
Hello. Thank you so much, Bella and Ale, for having me and just inviting me into this space. So like Ale mentioned, my name is Kylie Foster. I am currently a sophomore studying at the George Washington University. I double major in public health and criminal justice. I just see a great intersection and interconnection between public health and criminal justice. And I think we can dive deeper into how there are certain societal issues that criminal justice has that, you know, with the presence of public health, they're the reason why they are issues to begin with in the first place. So, you know, without reforming criminal justice, public health won't change and vice versa. So alongside Rethinking DC and co-leading that research project and working side by side with Ale, who's amazing, I might add. So alongside Rethinking DC, I actually hold a position on the George Washington University's Black Student Union. I am the VP of Community Service and Outreach. And basically that just holds the responsibility of orchestrating all the fundraising and community service events that all the Black students on campus take part in. Obviously, everything that we've done so far is in virtual space. So it's very unique, very fun. And then on top of Black Student Union, I'm also a mentor, part of Black Girl Mentorship, which is another organization at the George Washington University. And so all of the Black women that are upperclassmen get paired with a mentee who's a freshman woman of color. And so that's just kind of a great space to share our knowledge, share our wisdom and our experiences as Black women on the campus, because it's something so limited and so valuable. So I have a freshman mentee. She's super nice, super cute. Mentorship and advocacy is just something I've taken on at the George Washington University. And obviously we can touch on that a little bit further, but that's all I have for right now.
Thank you so much, Kylie. It's personally so nice to meet you because I've never met you before and you sound so amazing. So I hope, you know, when we go back to DC and eventually when things are safer, we can meet up. But thank you so much for being here. And with that, I want to introduce the amazing Tatiana Washington, who I have the pleasure of knowing and working with. I met Tatiana when I was an intern at Brady United Against Gun Violence, and she was on the Team Enough Executive Council, but now we presently work together at March for Our Lives on the policy team, and she's the state policy associate. But Tatiana has done so much more as well, so I'll let her introduce herself. So welcome, Tati.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tatiana. I am from Milwaukee, and I got involved in community organizing and activism in 2017. My aunt shared a shot and killed by her husband, who was a Milwaukee police officer, and he then turned the gun on himself. And ever since then, I've been really involved in Milwaukee and in community organizing through gun violence prevention work, addressing police violence, and education reform, and so many other issues. I'm currently the executive director of 50 Miles More, which is a Black youth-led organization that focuses on liberation through radical Black feminism, and also a state policy associate with March for Our Lives, where I know Bella.
Queen.
Thank you so much for both introducing yourselves and for being here. We're so excited. I think I can't stop saying that, honestly. I texted Bella before we started, actually. I was like, I am actually so excited for today because, like, their stories are just, like, amazing, and, like, everything they do is, like, amazing, and I essentially want to just be like, everything you do is what I want to do. So kind of like, if you want to tell us, I know Tati and Kylie, you both hinted, like, spoke about it a little bit, but like, kind of go into like why you became an activist, like, if you wanted to kind of go into more detail about how you became passionate about the issues, about your specific issues, and like kind of what you're doing within your realm of activism.
Yeah, I can go first, Ale.
So I think the period in time where activism actually truly came into my life was when I was 17 years old and I got diagnosed with polycystic ovary syndrome, and which, if you don't know, it is the leading cause of fertility among women, especially Black women. So being at such a young age and being diagnosed with such a heavy disorder, it was just something that was just completely just challenging and transformative. And I really took that time to not only think about how the disorder had affected me in the past, but I also felt a feeling of there's probably so many people at my high school that are dealing with issues, whether in a health perspective or a mental health perspective, that I just don't know about, that teachers don't know about, that their friends don't know about. And I was just, you know, thinking, you know, how can I make my school community better for not only me, but for others who are challenging with similar challenges? And so with that, I began the Teen Health Awareness Club at my high school, and that took flight my entire junior and senior year of high school, where I just shared an enormous space with a bunch of high school students, and we would just come together and talk about what we were struggling with, what we were trying to do to help navigate in the academic space that we were in, and the social space that we were in, and the individual space we were in. So there's a lot of complexity to it, but I think we all need to give ourselves grace for trying to be who we needed to be when we were younger, you know, and not only for ourselves, but the people around us that we love. And so I think that's when activism really started for me. And I started learning more about the maternal mortality rate within African-American women as it stands today, especially in Washington, D.C., you know, it's an all-time high. And it's something that obviously me as a Black woman, my twin sister as a Black woman, it's something that is inevitable for us. Not necessarily the maternal mortality rate, but how Black women, period, are disrespected and neglected in the medical space. And so that's kind of when I decided that being a public health major would be something that would help me target that disparity that's happening in America. And then after taking, you know, a bunch of public health courses and really developing what it means to be a public health activist and a public health student and a public health reformer, I started getting into criminal justice with an intro to criminal justice course, you know, and I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the material and the way it tied into public health. And I saw, like I said in the beginning, how both fields interconnect and intersect so well, but they also intersect so severely that they both exacerbate one another, you know? And learning about the opioid crisis and learning about the juvenile justice system and how brutal it can be for a lot of youth, and specifically Black youth, you know, I decided to take on criminal justice as a double major just to help myself flourish in those educational fields, which brought me to developing and co-leading Rethinking DC, like Ale mentioned at the beginning. So basically, to expand more upon that, it's a group of research cohorts of about 11 students in the George Washington University. And we work side by side with Metropolitan Police Department, MPD. And we just collaborate and we talk on ways in which we can help the juvenile justice system within DC, the educational system that kind of fuels the school to prison pipeline that we see in America today, which is highly problematic. And so it's people like Ale and people like me that are, you know, just trying to put our activism foot out there and at least trying to make a change and make a difference during these troubling times with COVID-19, which I know we can touch on in a minute, has been, you know, fairly difficult. But I think with every single angle of activism, no matter where you start, like, you have to start somewhere. And it might not be the most comfortable place to start. It might not be the angle that you want it. But I think just starting any type of activism is better than just watching activism happen around you. We all see activism happening every day, all day. We see it on Instagram. We see it on the news. We see it on Twitter. We see it when our friends send us articles, you know, we witnessed a great deal of activism happening. But I think we all have that DNA in us to actually jumpstart our own activism. It just starts with what we're interested in and we can move forward.
Something you said is really kind of, I found really interesting in the scope that, like, you can be part of the activism or you can just let the activism happen around you. And I think that's, like, really important because, like, kind of as we discussed even, like, last episode, it's, like, kind of even just putting something in your story, it kind of goes into the kind of, like, pierces the bubble of another person. And, you know, like, a lot of things, for example, that, like, gets, for example, like, Bella might put on her story, I think, oh, my God, like, I didn't even know of that. And, like, I'll put it on mine. So kind of, like, I'm kind of becoming part of the activism, but I'm also kind of, like, letting it happen and, like, allowing it to shape me. So that's actually something, like, when you said that, I was like, oh, like, I didn't look at it in that perspective, if that makes sense.
Right. And I think that's the beauty of, you know, even being an activist or sharing a space with other activisms is you have to play both parts. You have to be an activist and you also have to be susceptible to learning from other activists. It's being vulnerable to listening to others and also taking that information and, like you said, kind of spitting it back into the world. You know, every information that you receive, there's something that can be done with it. It can either be held with you or it could be, you know, expelled out into the world for something greater. And I think we're all in a space at a time in life where we can both do, you know, we can both listen to what's being put out there, but we also have a greater part of us that has, I guess, like a bigger duty to fix the things that we want to see change before we, you know, we go out in the world and we depart from the world and, you know, and after that, it doesn't matter, but for now it does matter.
Yeah. And Kylie, I can't imagine how you must have felt receiving that diagnosis at such a young age. And I'm just, it's so admirable the way that you turned that into action so quickly in high school. Like, wow, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I will be honest, you know, and I will be vulnerable in this space. You know, when I got diagnosed, it was one of the worst moments of my life, you know, and I it's something I try my hardest not to remember and not to reflect on, just because it was just a really, you know, traumatic moment for me. Like, no one wants to be told that you might not be able to have the kids that you dream of having one day, you know, but at the same time, I'm lucky that I was able to pick up on that moment and to try and channel in it to, you know, do something better. Even though I was, you know, diagnosed at a young age, I do feel like it's one of those things where what helped me to move on is I realized there are people out there that have it worse than me, you know, they're just people that have it worse than me. They're people less unfortunate than me. It's kind of that cycle that never ends, you know, it all depends on perspective and where you want to put yourself. And it's all about perception. So I really do hope, you know, whether I do have the ability to have kids or one day or at all, you know, that for me doesn't matter in the long run. What matters is what can I do with my diagnoses and kind of the same process, deal with a different process, or how can we change the medical system to see what Black women are going through in a health perspective in a different way, you know?
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing. Tatiana, do you want to answer the question as
yeah.
well?
Yeah. I think the reason why I got involved in activism was just to have a personal story. And like, that's really the only reason why my day-to-day, like I do the things I do is because of my aunt, but also just like my community. Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the country, has one of the highest incarceration rates for Black men in the country. And knowing all these things and then like going to school and seeing we don't have textbooks, the meals, the school lunches are disgusting, and it's like we like Black students deserve so much better than that. Up until my sophomore year of high school, I went to a school in the suburbs and it was predominantly white. And when I transferred to school in my city, I was in shock of like the complete difference it was. And it wasn't, you know, like it was like the students or anything, it was the resources. And it was just like so shocking to me. And then to see my community and my neighborhood militarize and seeing like, where is this money going? Like, why am I going to class and I don't even have textbooks for the class? Why am I going to a class that has 45 students in it with like one teacher? Why are our teachers not getting paid enough? All these things I was seeing, which is like really upsetting me, and all this kind of happened at once. And I think really just for me, it's just a love for my community, like love for people, that's really like makes me like want to do this work. And I also think, you know, all of our freedom dreams, the things that we want, can come true. And I really believe that. And there's so many people that tells you no, that these things can't happen. But literally, like, why can't they happen? You know, we have this country that's literally built on white supremacy and genocide and all these things. Why can't we reimagine a better world for all of us? And I think that's really, at the end of the day, like, why do this work? And like, why I enjoy organizing, because I want that. I'm really passionate about curating safe spaces for Black youth, especially Black queer youth and young Black women, because so often those are the most marginalized voices and most marginalized people that are impacted by policy. So
I thank you for sharing your story. I don't know what else is, like, in sense of, like, what apart from thank you, because both of your stories are so powerful, and it kind of just makes it seem like, you know, a lot of people do take, like, a bad situation that occurred to them and just kind of let them, like, kind of in a way eat them alive, but you actually got your situation, and, you know, you kind of didn't back down from it, you let it empower other people, and you kind of took your voice and put it kind of in a megaphone, and were like, this is not going to happen anymore, this cannot happen anymore. Which I think is a really big thing that, like, a lot of people don't realize that the impact of their voices can have, even if it's just, like, a minor, like, to them might be, like, a huge issue, but other people, like, might not have, like, passion towards that issue. Just, like, bringing awareness to it can shape, like, an entire community and, like, just change the country as a whole.
I totally agree. And with that, so what was the day-to-day life of your organizing before the pandemic, and how did it change? What were you focused on during COVID-19, and did you do any election work, and just, like, how has it been for you in 2020 as well?
Yeah, I can take this one first. For me, you know, I've been always so heavily ingrained in my community. A lot of the work didn't stop. I think when things, like, first shut down, I was doing a virtual space for Black youth just to come and talk. And it's, like, very casual, just, like, young people coming together and discussing things. And that was pretty much it, because it's just something that, like, you know, again, I'm just so passionate about having that safe space, and it's super duper important. I think it's a very radical act. Over the summer, with this almost, and I hate to say this, but the revival, this movement for Black Lives, and really just the media in white America started paying attention to it. During 50 Miles More, we organized a 65 Mile March, and I really wanted to make sure everyone stayed safe, and I'm really glad that no one got COVID after that march. That's something I was really big on. The folks that I organized with and work with, we went to D.C. for the March on Washington, and that was also big, making sure we stayed as safe as possible. Fortunately, none of us got COVID. But I think really what this pandemic is showing us is that all these institutions that we know and have known forever didn't work, I think it's being highlighted and heightened at a different extent. And I think that's been a difference in my activism. I think more people are realizing that. I can go into spaces and say that we should start talking about abolition. I've done abolition teach-ins, and folks that actually came before, the interest might have not been there. So I think, you know, in a sense, my activism has been able to be more, a little more radical. And you'll discuss these ideas with different people. And I think that's something that's been different.
I completely agree with what Tati is saying about the idea of how activism now is becoming more radical. And it's also becoming more, now I don't want to say idealistic, because I feel like activism and being a part of revolutions has always been radical. But I think giving grace to social media and the fact that we're now more attentive to the societal issues that are happening around us, you know, such as police brutality and food apartheid, food deserts, and just in simple, the health disparities that COVID-19 has been brought out. It's a scary time we're living in, but at the same time, it's weird that it took something like COVID-19 to happen to actually show society, especially those that were ignorant to a lot of the issues that were happening nowadays, what actually is going on, how many families are being affected, how many employees are being affected, how many minorities are being affected. You know, you can't look at you can't look anywhere and not see that someone isn't being affected by COVID-19 in some way, shape, or form or another. Everyone is. Everyone, you know, the idea of activism being more radical, I think, just this day and age and what's happening in the world around us, we're now actually being aware of how much of an impact COVID-19 and all of the inner workings of society have actually failed us, has actually failed Black women, have actually failed Black men, Hispanics, immigrants, everyone, you know? And I think it's ugly at the fact that everything is being brought to light so quickly and so suddenly, but it needed to happen. And this summer, I think we can all testify that it was just a crazy shift in energy that we all felt just, you know, looking at the news and reading articles and seeing how COVID has already impacted, you know, some of our families.
So obviously, activism for me shifted this summer, of course, when we got word that we weren't coming back to campus. And so I was beginning leadership work with the Black Student Union and just working with the entire executive board on what we wanted to accomplish throughout the year and just trying to get ahead with how we're going to cater to the Black students at the George Washington University without actually being on campus. And so Black Student Union's chief of staff, Bishop Walton, he came up with the idea of hosting a research program that tied together Metropolitan Police Department and youth diversion. And that was something that interested me right off the bat because I was just getting into learning about criminal justice. And so I reached out to him and I was just like, yo, your idea is amazing. And it seriously is going to go so far at the school. And it's something that a school and a PWI like the George Washington University needs. And I was just telling him how I would love to be a part of it, just orchestrating and planning the whole thing. And so basically for the rest of the summer, him and I were just, you know, working together side by side on working on the metrics, how many students were going to be a part of the research cohort, who was going to lead the research cohort, just basically all the questions we were trying to answer just to get the idea up and running and working on the proposal. So I think Rethinking DC was really basically the jumpstart of when virtual activism really started for me. And I've loved working with it ever since, especially working side by side with all LA and seeing her passion come to full fruition in this space. It's amazing to see how every single student a part of our research cohort sees something that they want to change about the criminal justice or the juvenile justice system. It doesn't just stop with the mass incarceration rate. You know, it's also talking about the opioid crisis, the adultification of Black females, the sex trafficking network, the school to prison pipeline, recidivism rates. There's so many issues that target and hyper target Black individuals in the criminal environment that we experience today, that it's so remarkable and it's so pivotal that we are all working on something different and we're all working in ways to better the DC community and better just basically Black lives and Black youth in the DC area. So it's great that we're working on something on the micro level, but we hope to bring macro level change. So Rethinking DC has honestly been basically the greatest activism project that I've been currently working on. But I also did a little bit of voter activism work. I did actually sign up to be a volunteer and to be a poll worker during the 2020 election. But Los Angeles is very, very populated with people that are already up and running with poll working, and so I was just on standby basically, but I did do my due diligence to at least, you know, post on my Instagram about ways you can further get involved when voting, you know, dates close, where polls are, and just doing my micro work there. And so I did a little bit of work for just voter suppression in general in that aspect. And then I think moving forward with what I really want to touch on during winter break is food apartheid, especially in Los Angeles. There's a part of Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles, that is home to over 200,000 Californians. And there's only 90 grocery stores to supply 200,000 people. It's not ideal. It's structured racism. That's what it is, you know? And so I really do want to dive deeper into the inner workings of food apartheid and how we can basically get rid of it, especially in South Los Angeles, because it's something that is in dire need of change here. There should be, there's such complexity in it. And it's something that is deeply rooted in racism. It's something that's deeply rooted in obviously bias and ignorance. And it's something that really needs to change. And I want to focus on it for just winter break, honestly. But that's pretty much all I have.
I'm curious, like, what is Rethinking DC? Like, what do y'all do?
So what Rethinking DC does is pretty much the name. We are rethinking the ways in which youth is treated and healed in the Washington, D.C. area, specifically in underrepresented and underprivileged wards like Ward 7 and Ward 8. So Rethinking D.C. itself is our tag for social media. We have an Instagram account, which is rethinking.dc. And we basically post on there all of the work that all of the research cohorts do, all their projects. There's, I want to say, 5 different projects that we're currently working on. And all of them are touching on the juvenile justice and criminal justice system, specifically in DC in some shape or form. But Rethinking DC, the Instagram page, is something where we can showcase the work that we're doing and the work that we're passionate about and the issues in DC that we want to bring to light and show other GW students and other students, potentially just across America in general. I think next semester we're really going to help and try to navigate other schools such as NYU, Boston University, USC, just those major institutions around the country that are in those hot pockets where police brutality is something that can't be ignored and something that does need rethinking. And so hopefully next semester we can broaden research and broaden activism to those greater schools.
They're actually, I guess, like, I can also be a little bit biased because I'm in the cohort, but they are actually amazing.
Lemonade is amazing. Like, if you want, Ale, like, why don't you touch on Lemons to Lemonade a little bit, just to give the audience an example of what research cohorting for Rethinking DC is about.
Yeah. I didn't think about that. Thank you. So our project, there's a class and there's, like, the federal work study. I'm in both. So, for example, more specifically in the class, we developed the Lemons to Lemonade project, which is a mentorship program for youth who've already been part of the criminal justice system in DC who've been released from prison. And it actually gives them, like, an opportunity to acquire mentorship and applying to higher education and also applying to employment. So it actually, we have a very, like, specific program in place, depending on whichever one you do, that actually helps them go through the entire application process. For example, specifically speaking, like, being a first-generation immigrant, like, you gave me FAFSA, and I, to this day, I don't know how 17-year-old me did it without committing some type of illegal thing, because I don't know how to do it. My mom doesn't understand English, and, you know, I had her support, but a lot of kids don't have this familial support to help them throughout the entire process. And as we kind of were developing the program, we thought that was, like, really important for them to have the feeling that somebody was always going to be there no matter what. So we developed this mentorship program, which surprisingly, like, on Instagram, like, you know, we, like, again, because of COVID, like, everything's online. So we have, like, a bigger base than we thought. Like, it's under 100 people following it, the count. But it's, like, for example, like, Georgetown Justice Law Center, or, like, there's, like, a bunch of, like, books to prison accounts that are, like, specifically called that, like, just bring educational resources to prisons, which is really important. So, like, we've got, like, a big foundation base of, like, people actually reaching out to us, like, either to be mentors or even mentees, which is really cool because it's not something that we even imagine kind of, like, already people talking or, like, wanting to be involved in. But then more in, like, the federal work study base, it's kind of, like, my partner Grace Sully and I, we're focusing on looking at all the past DC court judge ruling on juvenile cases and seeing if there's any possible bias within their rulings over the past, like, 10 years, which is, like, a lot of work. And we've had to, like, modify the plans because of COVID and, like, accident records. But yeah, like, in that sense, it's kind of looking at specifically how youth have been impacted within the criminal justice system, but then also kind of helping them reinstate, like, becoming part of society, and kind of using their voices and their narratives to build up and kind of not kind of let their path define who they are in the future.
So with that being said, and both of you being so involved and doing so much, what do you recommend to other activists in general when it comes to self-care? Like, how do you set those boundaries? I know personally, like, I was working at 2 organizations for the election, and that got really, really overwhelming. And it even affected my grades and all that. At one point, I was just like falling behind, and you feel like this overwhelming responsibility to take care of the world around you that you watch is like burning. But at the same time, you know, you have to take care of yourself. So I think we'll start with Tatiana, because I feel like, since, you know, we're in the same organization, the same line of work, like, how do you do it? How do you balance? How do you self-care? And how do you set boundaries to people and organizations that you work with as well?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, you know, self-care. And I, when I think about this, like, self-care is like very like revolutionary act in the world of white supremacy and capitalism and all these things. Like, the last thing that the system wants us to do is take care of ourselves. So when I think about that, it's so many things. It's, you know, making sure I'm drinking water. I went to a summit last year in Denver, and it was like some very good advice I never thought of. And it sounds kind of funny, but this woman's Black woman, she asked, she's like, how's your poop schedule? Are you pooping regularly? And I never thought about that as in a sense of like health, like self-care. And I was like, no, that's right. Like, make sure you're pooping regularly, because then maybe it's like your diet, or maybe like you're stressed out, and like making sure you're in tune with your body. I think it's also something that like you don't really talk about, but that's true. But also doing things that I actually enjoy to do, like reading or just sitting down and like binging a show on Netflix, is an act of self-care and something that I do, and I feel good about it, because I'm like, this is not something that I'm supposed to, like, the world does not want me to enjoy things, you know, they, like, the world does not want to see Black joy. And I think that's the biggest thing to me, is just like having those moments where I'm just having fun, and being Black and being a woman in this world, it's just sometimes that's all I can do for the day, but it's more than enough.
That was amazing and great advice, and that's so true. Like, sometimes your existence yourself is rebellion in itself, is rebellion. It is like going against the system. It is like embracing what really matters and what things should be. And I think that's so important, like just sleeping whenever you want to sleep, or having a moment to step away from your computer. Because I think, like, especially with COVID, we're constantly being like drawn to our computer for school, for Zoom meetings, and constantly staring at this system, this machine. And it's like that's not good for you. It's not good for your eyes. And we're being told like, no, you have to do it. And while I get like, we do have to continue on with life, like, we also have to be conducive to the fact that we need to go outside as well. So sometimes, like, just even like doing meetings outside like helps, but it still feels like I'm cheating myself out of my life. But I think the way you put it is perfect. Like, even the simplicity of pooping, like, it's like, wow, like, you know, that's liberating in its own way.
No, like, Bella, you actually said something, like, the going outside part. Like, I wake up, so when a school was in session, like, it would be hard for me to step away from my computer, because the moment I woke up, like, I had a 9:35, so moment I woke up at, like, 8 in the morning, whenever it may be, until, like, 10 p.m., right, like, I wouldn't step away, and if I did, I felt like I was, like, sabotaging myself, or, like, my grades, or something, and it was, like, this remorse in my head, and I was, like, this doesn't happen when I'm in school. Like, I know, like, 7 p.m., like, I'm done, like, I can't do any more work.
I completely agree with what all three of you are saying, especially, you know, like, what Tati was saying with just like the little things, like, did you poop? Did you drink water? Like, that's so valid. And what Bella touched on in reference to rebellion, you know, the art of being an activist is that you're actively rebelling against society in some way or form. So the worst thing you can do as a rebeller of society is rebel against yourself and rebel against your body. And I think that's such a great, you know, note to leave in the back of your head, especially in those moments when you're like Ollie, who, you know, wakes up in the morning and the first thing you do is, you know, you look at your emails, or you check your phone, you know, you start working on an assignment. You know, the work that you put in today, it'll always be here tomorrow. You know, you can always pick up where you left off, and it's okay. It's okay to take those naps. It's okay to take that walk. It's okay to, you know, meet with your friends when you want to, you know. I think it's all about balance.
I completely agree. I think, honestly, sometimes I think about the beginning of human existence and what did they do, and I feel as though, you know, like, just the capitalist system in general is just constantly like the complete opposite and going against human nature. And just the idea of 9 to 5, the idea of like waking up and being a little kid before the sunrise and going to school to learn, and you didn't have proper breakfast, like, those aren't good things. Like, being taught that, you know, education and work is more important than the relationships that you have with people. And it always felt like to me, and I think also because I have sisters who are very like artsy and into nature, like it always felt like to me that I was going against human nature. I mean, like we are all, I think, collectively working to abolish these systems that are like making us go against our human nature in some sense. And I think that with that, we have to like also do those things like in our own time, even though it feels like regretful, if that makes any sense. But yeah, so Ale, you want to go into the next question?
I think we actually talked about what you think the future of activism will be on the ground, because, you know, pre-pandemic, everything was very grassroots movements, like going, you know, for example, like even voting, like canvassing door to door. And kind of what do you think, or like, what is your opinion on like what the future of activism is as we're kind of the power of social media is being shown now more than ever?
You know, it's actually funny that activism is now taking on form of technology and social media, because also one of the greatest, you know, movements of, you know, activism and going against what society stands for today is actually going against social media. So it's actually interesting that you have this dichotomy relationship with technology where we actually don't need more than what we're using right now, but at the same time, it's kind of all we have in terms of the way we communicate and the way that we activate. So it's going to be interesting to see if we can navigate in a world in the next couple of weeks, the next couple of months, if we can take on activism in more personal and tangible forms. That's something that's debatable depending on, you know, obviously safety regulations and what the POTUS wants for us and what the POTUS wants in general. But yeah, no, that's interesting. That's interesting to speak on just social media in general. I personally think that social media activism will flourish the way that it did this summer over and over again, just as the same time as society continues to prove itself the wrongdoings of it, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think, so there's a few things. I think one, that like social media, like activism, to an extent gets a bad name, like, you know, like you hear like clout of it, which is like true and valid, but like I have had so many people who I've never met before, or like don't live in my city and like don't see, you know, the work that I do on the ground day to day, like when I post things and then they tell me like they've learned so much, you know, from things I've posted. It's like, okay, like I'm still making impact even though I'm not always, you know, on the ground doing community organizing work. I think that like that should continue. The other thing I'll also say is, and this is something, you know, that's been going on since forever, literally forever, like when thinking about our elders and my ancestors, like the surveillance of like radical activists, but I think it's almost to a different way and an extent because of social media. Like I've had like so many like cops DM me from like these fake accounts, like, you know, it's them, like I'm not stupid, or police literally just watching, you know, folks social media when protests are happening, or being able to hack and tap into phones and like all these things that like have happened before, but I think it's almost to like a different extent and in ways that like I definitely wasn't prepared for over the summer, like how like folks are getting criminalized because of social media and activism. A lot of it's due to social media. That's the one thing I think is different. And like, I think you have to hold, you know, Twitter and like all these sites accountable for like selling our information and things like that. That's a whole the conversation on like capitalism in our social media. But I think that's something that's big. I think in the future, I think the things are going to continue. I think we can do real impactful work on social media. I do think, you know, of course, like protesting and like going to marches are very impactful too. But yeah, I think we're just like evolving to a new space of activism. I think it's like one way or another that's bad or good or bad. I just think whenever we're doing activism organizing, the folks that are most impacted by policy seem to be at the forefront. Their voices seem to be heard. So it was like a cis heterosexual white man posting about Black Lives Matter. It's like, what are like, why aren't like user platform uplift, you know, Black people and their voices, or, you know, anything else. So,
you know, it's very true. Like sometimes social media can be incredibly harmful. and put those marginalized individuals more at risk at the expense of someone just trying to get a hashtag out of it and look better for themselves. And that's what like the scary part is. But I also think that in general, it has allowed us to, you know, see things that we may not have seen or become more aware as well.
Just kind of to add to that real quickly, I think it's also like, I don't know about you guys, but personally, I've seen like the true side of people in that sense of like, whether they're like just on social media of like for the clout of it, or they're just like for the, they're using the momentum to help themselves. Or like, for example, like when I kind of like stalk people kind of, you know, as everybody does, I kind of look through their social media, and like a lot of them are like posting, for example, like the specifically like the black, just the black post. And then you go up and there's like nothing else. Right. So it's kind of like using that momentum. I'm like, okay, so you use that one thing, okay, you identify as an ally, like, what else do you do? Like, I'm not saying, like, everybody has to, like, you know, 100% be, like, on the ground, like, you know, fighting, but I'm also saying, like, you know, that one thing is not going to kind of cause this change, and it's just kind of, I don't know about you guys, but personally, I feel like it's just going to make it look negatively of, like, you're just doing this for the clout and using the momentum to help your self-image, like, oh, you didn't do it, like, why didn't you do it kind of thing, rather than actually using it for a change.
Yeah, I think performative activism is something that I think a lot of us saw this summer, at least, you know, with everyone posting, you know, the black box, for example, you know, like there's so many people I feel like that we either went to high school with or even college with that, you know, just posted the black square, you know, just for the nick of it and just, you know, to save face, basically, is what Ollie is saying, you know, which, you know, I think a lot of people's true colors, you know, showed this summer. But I think that is one thing I am hopeful about moving forward with social media activism, is I think activism, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like activism at this time in our life is becoming less and less performative, because I think there was such like an awareness to it during the summer with the upbringing of the Black Lives Matter movement again. I think that a lot of people were quick to call out family members, peers, friends that they've had for years, you know, about just, you know, how, you know, how they've exacerbated, you know, Black people's lives. So it's like, you called my friend the N-word, why are you posting the black square? Like, you have done zero in your whole life so far, so what are you doing, you know? And I for one have witnessed that happen this summer, so I know it's real. I know performative activism is real, and it is something that obviously will be prevalent for the rest of our lives. But I think moving forward with social media being so common and so radical, I think that the space and the size and the magnitude of performative activism is decreasing. I think people are having a greater sense of awareness to what is happening in the world around them, or the family or family members and whatnot. And so I think that's something that I am thankful for about social media, is just the fact that people are realizing in ways that their activism has been performative, or, you know, instances where they were at a party and their friend called a black girl the N-word, and you know, you ignore a situation like that for years, and then it comes to light again. You know, certain situations like that happened in my community, for one, this summer. And so obviously, hopefully moving forward, that's something that we don't have to relive and keep seeing over and over again as time goes on. People are taking less form of the oppressor and more of the activist, the helper, the healer.
Okay, and with that, would both of you just like to, you know, leave us with a strong message? It could be about anything that you just want folks to hear at home, or whoever's listening, you know, just to convey your voice, whatever you want to say.
Any Black youth, you can join 50 Miles More Book Club. You can go to 50 Miles More on Instagram or Twitter to figure out how to sign up. And to learn more about 50 Miles More, go to www.50milesmore.org and take care of yourselves and read and be gentle and kind to yourself this new year.
To learn more about what we at the George Washington University are doing in hopes to bring awareness towards the juvenile justice system, the criminal justice system, and what U-Diversion has to offer in the future, feel free to check out our Instagram at rethinking.dc on Instagram. That is our only social media outlet. Also, feel free to look at the work of DC Justice Lab, the Black Swan Academy, Georgetown Juvenile Justice Initiative. And yeah, I just want to leave you with, thank you so much, Ale and Bella, for having Tati and I into the space just to talk about our experiences and your experiences. And yeah, I will just leave everyone with be kind to yourself. We're all a part of a revolution. Yeah.
Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today. It's been so amazing to hear your experiences, and I feel so inspired by both of your advocacy. So thank you so much for joining us on Call Her Madam.
Thank you for being here. And kind of just once again, if anybody who is listening to this podcast wants to get in touch with these two beautiful ladies, please feel free to reach out to you and we can kind of connect you to them or just to the work that they do so you can get more involved as well.
And I said, Mom, I am a rich man. You know, it's like I don't have to marry one.